A warning before we start. This podcast deals with child abuse and neglect. There is some strong language.
You're going to show up at my house, not tell me who you are, not tell me anything. Tell me you have some concerns, and that's when I flip out telling you I've got concerns. I just called the police. You still don't tell me who you are. Then you tell me you're going to take my kids from me. And I said, no, you're not taking my kids anywhere. That's a safety plan. When you don't even introduce yourself, tell me who you work for. Nothing.
Children's services agencies aren't supposed to just take kids from their parents. State and federal law requires them to make reasonable efforts to keep those kids safe in their own homes. And part of those reasonable efforts is making a safety plan.
I stated that the boys have said that Jamie, the aunt, is a suitable relative that we could look at for a safety plan. And she stated she did not want to do a safety plan and would rather the children go into foster care. And I explained to her that it would be all four children, not just the oldest two. At that point, she refused to do any type of safety plan, took the younger two, and they fled the home in her vehicle.
That's Athens County Children's Services caseworker Jacelyn McGackie speaking in court under oath on June 27th, 2022, 2 days after she showed up with a judge's order to take Teresa Fogel's children into the temporary custody of the agency.
I have kept requesting the safety plan. I was denied. We don't have that to give you. Why? If you offered me a safety plan, why can't you provide it to me? If I denied a safety plan, you're unable to provide that. Why?
Okay, and you're saying you've gotten no response.
Well, the one message said, we don't have a safety plan to provide you. You're saying that I denied a safety plan, but yet you don't have one to provide me?
From WOEB News, this is episode 2 of 150 Days. I'm David Forster.
And I'm Teo Peck Suzuki. If you missed the first episode, we suggest you go listen to that first. Otherwise, it might be hard to follow what's going on.
It took a long time for anyone to explain to Teresa what a safety plan actually was.
In fact, the people who finally wound up explaining it to her were us, months after the removal occurred. A safety plan is intended to address whatever concerns Children's Services has about the family. The agency is supposed to try a safety plan first, and only if that fails should it be going to a judge for an order to remove the children. The caseworker is supposed to work with the parent on the safety plan. And the plan might, and that's an important point, it might involve removing the children from the home for a while and placing them with relatives or in a foster home. And the difference here, just to clarify, is under a safety plan, it's not Children's Services taking custody of the kids, which sets in motion a whole legal process. It's kind of like they say, look, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. The easy way is you agree to let us remove your kids for a while. There's no legal process involved. You get your kids back when we're satisfied. Everyone's happy. The hard way is we go to court, which is what happened in Teresa's case. This is a kind of hard distinction for a lot of parents to grasp. In fact, I remember it was even hard for David to wrap his head around at first.
Right, because my first thought was, how can removing children be something you do to prevent the removal of children? I assumed we'd missed something.
Yeah, just to explain it again, a safety plan is an agreement between the agency and the parents. We're not going to go to court. We're going to do XYZ instead to neutralize the safety threat that brought us out here. And part of that can be, let's send your kids to a relative for a while. Once they get the order from the judge, it's too late for a safety plan. Now it's official. There's a court process, multiple hearings, the whole shebang.
But that distinction was lost on Teresa, as it likely would be for many parents. All she's hearing is that the caseworker wants to take her children, and she insists that at this point, the caseworker hasn't even identified herself.
She just shows up at my house. She doesn't tell me who she is. She doesn't tell me anything other than, are you looking for your kids? And I said, yeah, I just called the police because I'm pressing charges on my son. And she was like, well, I have some concerns. And I said, I have some concerns too. And then I just started freaking out. And that's, like I told you, I started going over all the charges from before we moved here. My son just tried to attack me with a hammer in my car, hitting my car with a hammer. I have some concerns, and that's why I just called the police. And then that's when she was like, well, unfortunately, my supervisor thinks that it would be best if we took the kids to a relative's house for the night. And I'm like, I don't know who the fuck you are or who your supervisor is, but you're not taking my fucking kids nowhere. I said, I just moved out here. You could be somebody just kidnapping my kids. I don't see a badge. I don't see anything but a folder in your hand, and you haven't showed me shit, bitch. You're not taking my kids anywhere. And that's when she was like, I'm not just talking about your boys. I'm talking about all your kids. I said, oh, yeah, well, fuck you. And I took my girls and I put them in my car and left.
Which we suspect constituted the refusal of the safety plan. And that is why Teresa's decision to drive off was, unbeknownst to her, disastrous. Removing children from a home is one of the most difficult decisions caseworkers have to make. No one wants to see children suffer because they were left in an abusive or neglectful home. At the same time, research and experience show removal is traumatic and can have lasting consequences. In fact, some studies have found that outcomes for children in foster care are worse, on average, than they are for kids who are left in genuinely abusive homes.
So it's a big decision, and that's why it's not just the caseworker who makes it.
Removing the child is the last resort.
That's Matt Starkey, the public information officer for Athens County Children's Services.
The team has supervisors. There's always an on-call supervisor, so 24/7, that's how we're able to respond, and those rotate. So there's always an on-call supervisor, there's on-call caseworkers, and these are the ones who, in the middle of the night, need to get up and go if they are called and investigate. The deputy director is most of the time there, or the director himself. So, you know, there are different levels of authority and different aspects of the agency. So we have our assessment department represented, and then our lawyer, who is from the prosecutor's office, she will also be there most of the time, you know, for these.
Once the team is signed off on the removal, they reach out to the Athens County Juvenile Court judge, Zach Saunders. He needs to sign the removal order, and then the caseworker can take the kids into the agency's custody.
Under Ohio law, children can only be removed from their home when it's necessary to prevent immediate or threatened physical or mental harm. That's a pretty high bar. To figure out whether that harm exists, caseworkers conduct what's called a safety assessment. These safety assessments are also required under state law. They are supposed to be done before the safety plan, and the purpose is to decide what kind of intervention, if any, is necessary.
You would go through a process of interviews with all parties to try to understand not just the allegations that might have been made. In this case, you're saying a child made the allegations.
This is Diane DePanfilis. She's a professor of social work at Hunter College in New York and the author of the Federal Guidelines for Caseworkers.
You would evaluate the quality of capacity of the parents to provide for the basic needs of children, food, clothing, shelter, education, nurturing, you know, the things that are required by law for children to be cared for. And there would be an assessment of what circumstances might indicate the likelihood of future abuse or neglect. That would be risk or factors that would jeopardize a serious threat of harm.
We also spoke with a public defender in Erie County, Ohio, named Kelly Jellinger, who often represents parents in child removal cases. She gave us this example scenario.
So they come to the house. Ding, ding, ding. I'm Susie from JFS. We have some concerns. These are the concerns that we have. We need to investigate those. They spend a half hour, an hour asking questions, looking around the property, talking to people, right?
That didn't happen in Teresa's case. We know this because of the dispatch call log, which includes time-stamped updates starting from Teresa's first call to the dispatcher.
Teresa calls dispatch a few minutes before 1. Jacelyn shows up at Teresa's house some minutes later. At 1:15, the dispatcher radios that Teresa has taken off with her daughters. If that's when Teresa, quote-unquote, refuses a safety plan, which is what Jacelyn testifies to in court, then it really doesn't sound like what either Diane DePanfilis or Kelly Jellinger just described. So the question is, when did the safety assessment, all those interviews and investigations and whatnot, when did that happen? We can't ask Jacelyn, but it's not easy to see logically when it could have taken place.
And this matters because by law, it's not enough to just talk to Teresa's oldest son, Josiah, and then go remove all of Teresa's children. State law requires a safety assessment. So, giving the agency the benefit of the doubt, the question is, when could they have done such an assessment? And the answer is, we don't know. But we do know, according to Matt Starkey, the Public Information Officer for Children's Services, that it's not just the caseworker doing this on her own. Starkey mentioned earlier that the caseworker reports to a team.
These meetings are not the caseworker says, I have given you the facts of the case. It is, okay, what did you see when you got there? What was happening? What were the factors that led you to believe that there was a cause of harm? You know, there's questions. And so these are very intense, where the caseworker is, for the first time in, you know, the case, which probably won't be the last time, is put on the stand. You know, they're put on the stand in front of their coworkers, their supervisors, the director, the deputy director, and they're being told to describe the situation, they're being asked questions about the situation, and it's all in an attempt to get the facts, the actual facts of the case together. Because we don't want to get to court and find out that a caseworker lied to us. You know, we want to get to court and have all of the facts available so that we can give our best case in front of the judge.
I think it's safe to say that David and I spent most of this story asking one another repeatedly, what did we miss? What could we possibly have overlooked that would bridge this gap between what Matt Starkey is telling us, this team that is collectively evaluating evidence and making these carefully informed decisions, and what we observed in Teresa's case? And I'm not sure we ever got an answer to that question, because again,
the system is just closed off.
And that means we, as members of the public, cannot see why Children's Services made the decisions they did. Period. End of story.
Let's leave the particulars of Teresa's case aside for the moment and imagine we're dealing with a case in which the safety assessment definitely does happen. In fact, let's go one step further and say during the safety assessment, the caseworker finds that a child likely is in immediate danger of serious harm. The next step, the only next step according to state law, is for the agency to develop a safety plan.
The purpose of this safety plan is to identify concrete steps that deal with the danger to the child. That might involve the child going to stay with a relative for a while, but it might not.
For example, let's say there's a violent boyfriend. Part of the safety plan could be a voluntary agreement that the boyfriend won't stay in the house. This kind of agreement does not involve the court system. That's the advantage of a safety plan in comparison to a formal removal.
Also, the agency is supposed to design the safety plan with input from the parents. It's supposed to be recorded on a form, and the parents are supposed to sign that form.
At this point, removal is not on the table. The only time removal becomes an option is when the parents are unable or unwilling to participate in a safety plan. That could mean that they're refusing to do a safety plan, or it could mean that they agreed to a safety plan, but they're just not following it. Once that happens, and only once that happens, the agency goes to the judge and asks for the removal order. And at that point, or shortly thereafter, the agency has to show the judge that it made reasonable efforts to prevent the removal.
This phrase, reasonable efforts, is one you'll be hearing a lot. It's basically a check in the system to make sure that the agency does the safety assessment and the safety plan and all that. Here's Erie County Public Defender Kelly Jellinger.
What's so important about a reasonable efforts determination is that cuts off federal funding. If a court deems that the agency has not made reasonable efforts, and they deem that, the federal government will come in and say, we are not going to supplement your budget or this child.
So that creates a strong incentive for agencies to make reasonable efforts, at least on paper.
The problem is it's a pro forma thing. You see some court orders, it's just a checkbox. reasonable efforts were made to prevent removal, or an emergency existed. Really? Like, what's the documentation of the emergency?
That's Jennifer Rennie of the American Bar Association. She spent over 30 years in the child welfare system, has written 3 books on it, and trains judges and attorneys on how to improve outcomes for families in juvenile court. Rennie's point is that often agencies could be doing more to prevent removals, which suggests that the checks and balances around reasonable efforts aren't working properly.
We look at data from every state, every county inside of every state, and we look at things like time from removal to reunification. And so in a lot of jurisdictions, it's 30 days or 60 days. We call them short stayers. We draw the conclusion that if you could solve the problems in a month, you could have solved them before you removed the child.
Let's go back to Teresa's case now. I'm going to quickly go through the allegations against her. These allegations come from the conversation caseworker Jacelyn McGackie had with Teresa's 2 teenage sons at the Gloucester Public Library on June 25, 2022. They're listed in a court document. 1. Teresa's boyfriend was violent, attacked Josiah with a hammer, and threatened to get a gun and kill him. 2. There was no food in the house. 3. The family faced eviction and had a history of homelessness. 4. Teresa asked Josiah to buy marijuana for her. 5. Tyler drove erratically on the car ride back from Butler County after picking up the boys from their aunt's house. And 6. Teresa had a history with Children's Services in Butler and Warren counties. Caseworker Jacelyn said in a sworn statement that these were the conditions that justified removing the children.
But of those 6 allegations, there's only one that arguably posed an imminent threat of serious harm, which again is the legal requirement for removing children. That's the allegation Tyler threatened to hurt or kill Josiah. Given that, and based on what we know of state law, we would expect to see evidence of an investigation into this claim. Something more than just Josiah's allegation. But we don't. Not really.
Again, we can't see inside Children's Services. All their records, whatever assessment materials they collected, all of that is hidden from us. But if the agency did an assessment, it apparently didn't involve talking to Teresa or Tyler. And the law requires the assessment to include talking to at least one parent. Nor did the agency ever seem to investigate whether Tyler actually had a gun. That's particularly striking because Tyler is an ex-felon. He did time for residential burglary. He would be breaking the law if he had a gun. And Children's Services didn't interview other key witnesses, people who are clearly involved and could offer some perspective on the family, such as Sue McGee.
Sue's son is friends with Teresa's daughter. We talked about her in the last episode. She was actually there when the removal took place. If Children's Services had spoken to her for the safety assessment, they might have realized, hey, this thing about there being no food, Sue McGee is telling us something which contradicts that. Her son eats dinner at Teresa's house all the time.
All this matters because the agency has to make reasonable efforts to prevent removal. That is the law. And yet, it's hard to find any evidence of these reasonable efforts in this case. In fact, let's go back and listen to Jacelyn's testimony in court.
I stated that the boys have said that Jamie, the aunt, is a suitable relative that we could look at for a safety plan. And she stated she did not want to do a safety plan and would rather the children go into foster care.
In Jacelyn's own testimony, it sounds like she showed up with a safety plan already in mind. It does not sound like she arrived at Teresa's house to conduct a safety assessment or work with her on a safety plan. Even though the instructions for completing a safety plan specify, quote, the parents or caregivers are an integral part of the safety plan and should have a prominent role in its development and implementation, unquote.
We asked a bunch of experts how it's possible for the process to be so different on paper and in reality. Many told us this situation didn't sound unusual. Here's public defender Denise Ferguson, who represents parents in Cuyahoga County in Ohio.
Caseworkers don't always explain anything. Caseworkers don't always understand it themselves. What they do is they go out to a house, and a lot of times they go back and tell the supervisor, well, you know, she wouldn't talk to me. Okay, well, the children are in danger because we don't know that they're not. So let's file in court.
And here's Kelly Jellinger, another public defender who we heard from earlier.
She doesn't know what you're here for.
She being a parent.
That is her responding, saying, "You're not taking my children," to a woman who shows up and without any sort of evidence, without any sort of explanation, without any sort of on-the-spot investigation, questioning, answering, you know, talking to me, says, "You're going to take my children." The hell you are. You better come at me with more than, "If you don't do this, I'm taking your kids." But they call it a refusal.
Now, people who work in the system are telling us what happened to Teresa might not be that unusual. But that still doesn't explain why.
And the answer, or at least a big part of the answer, is that the child welfare system is in the middle of a crisis on two fronts. First, the system is totally overwhelmed with cases it doesn't have the staffing or the expertise to handle. Second, there's nowhere for these cases to go except for children's services. For those two reasons, the entire apparatus is chronically overstretched, and families are falling through the cracks.
In February 2022, researchers at The Ohio State University released a workforce report for the child welfare system in Ohio. It found that the caseworker turnover rate nearly doubled from 24% in 2016 to 45% just 3 years later in 2019. Now, that number did dip slightly in 2020 with the onset of the pandemic. It went down to 38%, and that's the latest data we have. Meanwhile, some county children's services agencies reported years where turnover was greater than 100%. That means these counties were effectively replacing their entire children's services workforce in a single calendar year.
We don't have turnover data from Athens County Children's Services, but we do know that the agency's website showed 6 vacancies in family services when Teresa's children were removed, family services being the part of the agency that handles removals. And in general, high caseworker turnover means cases stay in the system longer, and that means more trauma, both for families and for the caseworkers who remain.
The workforce report cites studies showing that more than half of Ohio's child welfare caseworkers experience stress levels that meet the threshold for post-traumatic stress disorder.
So they're seeing many of the same levels as returning veterans and other folks who experience a lot of trauma on their jobs. And that's also leading to the turnover that we're seeing.
This is Scott Britton, Assistant Director of the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio.
Caseworkers are really dealing with a lot. I mean, after the Great Recession, we've had 10 years plus of an addiction epidemic, started as an opioid epidemic, but in many ways, our caseworkers became first responders. Sometimes they were first on the scene of an overdose and were administering naloxone or telling a child in the next room that their parent was incapacitated.
Britton also says fewer veteran caseworkers means more young, inexperienced caseworkers getting in way over their head.
That's why our workforce crisis is so damaging, not just for our agencies, but really for children and families, because it means that we have 22-year-old college graduates put in situations where they are having to follow a very complex assessment and planning model, think on their feet, be aware of hundreds of different Ohio Administrative Code rules that govern their work, and make a decision that could impact this family for a lifetime, when ideally we would have folks who come into our system stay, gain experience, really develop those critical thinking skills, and are making those judgments from a place of having done this hundreds of times before and feeling very comfortable with it.
Agencies are doing what they can to address the issue, but they're fighting an uphill battle. Here's Matt Starkey from Athens County Children's Services again.
It takes a specific calling to be a children's services caseworker, and it takes persevering through that calling. You know, some people get here thinking that they're working with kids. You're working with families. That's the thing. And so we try to be very upfront with all of the caseworkers as they come on board, saying it's tough.
And that seems like pretty much all individual agencies can do: warn people that it's a tough job.
In the midst of this workforce crisis, Ohio's children's services agencies are fielding hundreds of thousands of calls a year. Some calls come from concerned family members. Others come from mandatory reporters who are required by law to report known or suspected child abuse.
Mandatory reporters include doctors, nurses, teachers, child care workers, lawyers, psychiatrists, members of the clergy, and social workers.
Each report goes through a screening process where the agency has to decide, sometimes based on very limited information, whether to screen it in. If they screen a case in, they have to investigate, no matter how overworked or understaffed they are. If it's an emergency, they have to have a caseworker out within an hour.
Most of the cases that get screened in are for abuse and neglect, which kind of fits the general idea of what Children's Services is supposed to do. Here's Scott Britton again.
Children's Services has always been that kind of arbiter of civil liberties, right? Parents have the right to raise their children the way they see fit. And the public interest is when there is abuse or neglect. And so there should be a high bar for sending somebody from the government out to knock on a door and interfere in a family's life.
But the thing is, it's not just abuse and neglect caseworkers end up conducting removals for. A report last year found that hundreds of children in agency custody were there for either behavioral health needs or developmental or intellectual disabilities. So no abuse, no neglect. Just no other place in the community for those kids to go. And caseworkers are having to find placements for them while also dealing with abuse and neglect cases.
That is another complicating factor that increases our caseloads for our very much reduced workforce that then can lead to decisions being made that tend to side toward, let's get that child to a safe place so that I don't have to worry about leaving them in what could potentially be a dangerous situation.
Britton's last point is really important. He's basically saying, look, caseworkers are stressed. They're overworked, and often they want to play it safe. And for a caseworker, playing it safe means taking the child out of the home.
Which brings us back to the original question of, how can you have cases, apparently many cases, in which reasonable efforts to avoid removal aren't really being made? As it turns out, circumstances compel them not to. Caseworkers are overwhelmed, inexperienced, and strongly incentivized to favor removal.
Now, the situation isn't hopeless. Britton says we know what will make things better. It's simple. More services for families. More help for people who are struggling before they get to Children's Services. That means things like a stronger mental health workforce and other social supports.
We need upstream supports, home visiting, nurses. There are great models out there for nurses' home visiting programs for new parents who are struggling with infants, more mental health and substance abuse treatment services, and parenting education. A lot of parents struggle as their kids get older and bigger and more challenging in their behaviors. They need resources where they can rely on what do I do as a parent to de-escalate this situation? We need all of that, and we needed it 10 years ago. But in the meantime, Children's Services has tried to fill the void, and we're not good at it.
But it's not really within Children's Services' power to will those extra services into being. That's something that communities and governments have to get on board with. In the meantime, the removals just keep happening.
I'd like to go back now to about a year before Teresa's children were removed, late May 2021. WOUB and several other news outlets published a story about a young woman from Athens County who ran away from home after years of sexual abuse within her family. She resurfaced a year later with a lengthy Facebook post about the abuse, which prompted an investigation. The investigation confirmed her reports. Her parents ended up in prison, and two of her brothers pleaded guilty to felony charges. It turned out that several reports had been made to Athens County Children's Services about the abuse, but the cases were always closed with little investigation.
This is exactly the kind of child welfare case that historically makes headlines. Stories like this one focus public attention and outrage on agencies and caseworkers. They prompt members of the public to ask, did the agency downplay or ignore warning signs? why didn't they move more quickly to get the kids out of a dangerous home? This public outrage then creates pressure for new laws and policies that encourage removals, and it amps up the pressure on everyone working in the system. No one wants to be the caseworker or supervisor or judge who leaves a child in a home and that child suffers serious abuse or dies.
And that's something that, unfortunately, is always in the back of your mind.
This is Athens County Juvenile Court Judge Zach Saunders. He's the guy who signs off on removals in Athens County, including Teresa's.
I don't let it consume me because I have to do the right thing. It's a hard thing to swallow, and that's a tough thing about this job. But I can't just say that that child can't go home because something has happened in California in the past. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to happen in this case. But again, it's a balancing act, and it's tough. It is tough.
There is an argument to be made that if the system is going to err, it should be on the side of removal. Better to remove some kids who would have been better off left at home than not remove kids who could wind up seriously hurt or dead. The problem critics raise with this line of thinking is that it misses just how harmful removals can be. And this is something that's easy to miss because, again, the press historically hasn't covered it. And so the public hasn't heard about it.
The reality is, removals are hugely damaging. Not like, oh, it's upsetting for a while. Not, oh, it takes some getting used to. We're talking about people who end up with lifelong trauma, not because of what their parents did, but because of being removed. People inside the system openly acknowledge this. Here's Scott Britton again with the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio.
We are one piece of a very complex system that has a lot of checks and balances to ensure that families aren't unnecessarily torn apart, which we know can be more traumatic for the children than the abuse or neglect that they suffered.
More traumatic than the abuse or neglect they suffered. That's not easy to square with the idea that it's safer to remove kids than to leave kids.
One of the most vocal critics we spoke to about all this was Richard Wexler. He's a former journalist who now directs the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform.
The only time generally people know about this system is a situation in which a child, quote, known to the system, unquote, has died, a horrible death. And then you find out, because it's one of the few things they can't keep secret, that the case file had more red flags than a Soviet May Day parade. So everybody thinks, how in the world could that have happened? So the knee-jerk response is, the system must be bending over backwards to coddle those horrible abusive parents.
Conversely, we almost never hear about unnecessary removals, which to Wexler is one of the many reasons why the system has evolved to make removals easier in practice than they are on paper. He feels it is a self-reinforcing cycle.
The real reason these things happen is the system is so overloaded with false allocations, trivial cases, and poverty cases, they don't have time to investigate any case carefully. But that's not what legislators see. So they pass a law to further make the system even bigger and even more powerful. And that happens over and over and over.
People within the system, people like Scott Britton, say child welfare workers are caught in a catch-22.
Most people aren't happy with children's services no matter what we do. We either do too much or we do too little.
But Wexler sees it differently.
I have followed this field now for more than 45 years, first as a reporter, now as an advocate. In all that time, I have never seen a caseworker fired, suspended, demoted, or so much as slapped on the wrist for taking away too many children. All of those things and more have happened to workers if they leave one child in a home and something goes wrong. So when it comes to taking away children, workers are not damned if they do and damned if they don't. They're only damned if they don't.
To Wexler, this idea that people are never happy with children's services no matter what they do, well, the scales clearly tilt one way and one way only, toward more removals. Not fewer. But he and others who share his view face a big challenge. building public and political momentum for reforms while contending with the wall of confidentiality that surrounds almost everything in the child welfare system.
A wall of confidentiality we could only poke through because Teresa Fogel decided she wasn't going to just follow along with what other people were telling her to do.
I have class. I am a sophisticated female. I'm not an idiot. I'm a very educated human. So I'm not a pushover. And nobody's going to make me out to be one.
Most parents are not like Teresa. Their stories go unreported.
In the next episode, we'll look at Teresa's first court hearing from her perspective. Children's Services has just taken her children. She's ready to fight. But from the moment she enters the courthouse, things don't go the way she expects.
The safety assessment, the safety plan, these are just the first steps in a lengthy process. Once the agency removes children, things go to court. Children's Services has to prove that the allegations against the parent are true. So what do they have on Teresa? That's next time on 150 Days. Days is a production of WOUB Public Media. The podcast was written and produced by Teo Peck Suzuki and David Forster. Adam Rich is the audio engineer. Music by Caitlin Kraus and Brad Swinarski. To read the digital version of this story, go to woub.org/150-days.